If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
All right, Don, well, preach for us, man.
This is Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. My name is Don Moore, and sitting across from me is someone that always makes me think of the nature of existence.
Wow.
How do you accept it when culture changes? And that can only be the one and only Mr. Al Val.
That's deep, man. That's deeper than I would have said, but, you know, I see it on your phone, so. Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy or Don Moore.
I never
come
up.
But not by me.
I hear somebody say these things, and, ooh, that's good, so I type it into my phone real quick.
I'm just talking about comic books, not even deep comic books. It's surface level, superficial, you know, well-drawn at times comic books. You know, yeah, it's funny. I used to be the biggest comic book art snob
all
time. And I'm not like that anymore. I think I've learned to accept all different styles.
You of all people, have absolutely, because I think when you're younger, you just like comic books, you know, and you're not really thinking, you can't really distinguish. And I think there's a certain point where you start being able to distinguish, and especially when you're in middle school age. That's when all of a sudden, this person's great, and this person is just, you know, beneath your attention.
Yeah.
And I got real narrow-minded about some artists. I thought, why, I'd even bitter the fact that, you know, why are they even wasting their time on this book? And then, you know, there's only certain artists I like a lot of different artists, but, you know, there's a certain type I like the best. And there's some I just don't really care for. But you, when I met you, you talk about some artists that I wouldn't touch with a 100-foot pole when I was younger. And now I think, well, actually, there were things they did that I appreciate and liked.
Yeah.
You've gotten a lot more forgiving about it.
I'm not even forgiving. I mean, I kind of like see it through different eyes now as opposed to back then. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, everything was like Kirby. You know, even as a kid, I could tell that, and you did too, and all the kids could pretty much, that Kirby was a lot more dynamic than all the other guys. It just popped through. It was almost like three dimension going through there, like in your face or whatever. And then when I started looking at the Warren mag, I started seeing these guys that, I'm not even tooting my horn, but even as a little kid, even as like a 7 or 8 or 9 year old, I could tell that some guys drew better than others because they just looked more realistic than others. Maybe it's just that I never wore them to cartoony art, like a Donald Duck or the Walt Disney's. I was always into, so I could always tell the difference between the realistic guys, you know, like some guys, like you could always see a Neil Adams was more dynamic than, say, a Kurt Swan. As much as I love both, you know,
right.
You could tell. You could tell that Kirby was a lot more dynamic than, say, like, I don't know, Kurt Schaffenberger or a DC or whatever typical DC artist at the time or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I love Kurt Schaffenberger.
I do, too.
But, certain of them, they just got to a comfort zone that they never got out of.
And they were greater. I think they were better in the 40s and 50s than they were in the 60s.
Yeah,
it's like you said, we talked about before how like artists become not complacent, but that once their style is set, it becomes like a like handwriting, you know what I mean? It's the searching, the achieving, the plateau has been reached as far as they're concerned, and it's perfect there.
And that's where they like to be.
And it becomes more economical as the years go by, it seems like.
But I still remember Kurt Schaffenberger. He continued to draw like his women. They always had that flip, you know,
the flip
hairstyle from the 60s. But he never seemed to leave that period. You know, once he hit the 60s, his work always kind of, I never stopped loving it. He's one of my favorites. He just hit that point, and he never really seemed to ever leave it. Even though he did draw things in a later styles, it always had that 60s look to it, you know.
Well, he also was doing the Captain Marvel stuff, I think, in the 40s and 50s,
so that
makes sense, you know. I didn't realize that. The more we were able to, when we both go to Digital Comics Museum and download old Golden Age books, you start to see, that's when your eyes open up and mine too, you start to see what these guys were drawing, like a lot of them in their prime maybe, and you're going like, oh, okay, I get it now. I see when we got up to you in the 60s, you had already like hit your peak in a way, not completely, but in a way, and you were kind of like streamlined, but when you're really like putting in all the extra, you know, time or effort or whatever the word is, I don't want to insult these people. Yeah, it's different. Like I posted a Schaeffenberger story on Destination Nightmare from the 50s, a sci-fi story. It was like, oh, I was like, wow, this is like, not that I'm a great lover of detail, but within his world, it was like, wow, this is really detailed and dynamic, and it looks like there's a lot more like, I don't know if the word is care, but I mean, there was a lot more in it than the Lois Lane stuff and the Jimmy
Yeah.
E. Olsen stuff from the 60s and stuff
Yeah,
like that.
which again, I still love those stories, but you're right, they got, I don't know, it was just so-so.
And it's a stylistic thing too. Is, you know, some people will like a told style. Some people, I mean, some people. You, I know you maybe, but I know my friend JC was telling me that when he first saw Toth and Warren, he hated it. He couldn't stand it. I always was like, wow, this is like amazing.
Hey.
This is like.
Alex Toth, it depends. Sometimes I saw he did some of those cartoons in Cartoons Magazine, and the Jolly Green Giant one. I
That
saw
was
that.
great.
It was great, but it was just so weird because it looked real and it wasn't real. And but there were some stories I'd seen, like some of those war stories in DC, and he had an absolute unique look to it. But at first, I think, well, I don't know. And then later I just started realizing I loved Alex Toth far beyond anything. But when sometimes you're younger, the taste isn't always there of what you want, you know. But yeah, he was one in a million.
Alex Toth is like fine wine. You
Yeah.
know, the more you like draw, the more you learn about drawing, and the more you get into drawing, you look at his work and you go like, how the hell did he do that?
All the time. But some of his earlier work, I think it's got a broad appeal. Even young
Yeah, it
kids would like
does.
it.
Yeah, it
But
does.
then, you know, sometimes it goes even further. And yeah, some of those stories he did, we always talk about the Fox stories he did, those backups. And
Yeah, oh, those are
Daddy in the
beautiful.
Pie he did for Warren, I think is probably one of the greatest comic stories I've ever read. And,
That was a great one.
you know, of course he didn't write that one, but it wouldn't have been as strong if he hadn't drawn it, if somebody else had. It's just, you know.
But you know, Joust was asking me to talk about some of the, well, I don't know what way to put it, but the non-superstar guys that worked for Marvel and DC. And I mean, I don't know what you think, but I came up with like my interpretation of it is that they were all kind of like superstars, but when I think about it, some guys were working on regular books, and there was some guys that just moved all over the place. You know what I mean? And I think that the more artistic guys, I mean, I'm gonna be, I'm, and somebody can correct me on this, and I could be wrong, but it seems to me the guys that were more, like, I don't know, more like the ones we consider the superstars, the ones that we consider better, would be doing a story for one company or for another company or a five pager or a six pager, but people like say Don Heck or Werner Roth or whatever, we're doing a steady book usually, and it's you gotta like you can't be like a superstar every issue, you know what I mean? Because you're unlike the only guy, one of the few guys that could do it is Kirby. Kirby could crank out the product and be a superstar. Not everybody could do that, but if these guys were given like not a deadline and a five-page story or whatever, and they were said, "Take your time, do like a beautiful artistic job," I think we would have seen them in a different light. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it depends on where you're working at. That's one thing I found when you're working in the graphic arts is you could be in one environment and you're the superstar, and you get to another company working for them and you're just a square peg in a round hole. You know,
Yeah.
it depends on what they're looking for, what they want. There's one person I've worked for, or I mean worked for me, that is a good artist on their own, and they do all kinds of different arts. And they're one of the most professional working people I've ever seen. They have a strong portfolio. They've won awards, and they do far more work than anybody else, and it's always unique. Usually, everybody has two or three tricks that they do, you know, like cropping things, how they arrange things. This person, it's endless. I never seen them do one or two things the same way all the time, but it's always very measured. You know, it's like it wouldn't be exciting if it was a comic book work. You know, it's
Yeah, I
mentioned
know
the
what you
sensation.
mean.
It's kind of like Kurt Swan. Kurt Swan, He was a great artist. I read a lot of his stories, but you could read his stories from the 50s all the way up to the end of the 70s and early 80s. It was always kind of the
Solid.
same. Yeah,
It was
solid,
always the
but
same, but it was solid,
it
yeah.
wasn't, spectacular or anything. And then there's other people that just do some of the wildest stuff, and you think, wow, this is incredible. And then the client loves it, but they're inconsistent. Once in a while, they have a flash of brilliance, and the rest of the time, it's just, But at other places, they could be doing that, and it's exactly what you need to do. And I think with some of the comic artists, I think Jack Kirby, basically, he just found an element that he thrived in, and he had the ability and the thought. He understood how it worked and how to go. Artists like Warner Roth, he was a good, he's an artist that Dallas loves.
And he's the guy who was working in the, he was a Golden Age artist too.
I never knew
All
much
those
about him.
guys, most of those guys were Golden Age guys that worked for Marvel and DC.
Where did Warner Roth come from?
Oh
Man,
God, I know he
how do
was
you
doing
say?
stuff in the early 50s and maybe even the late 40s for like major companies.
Yeah.
So was Don Heck. Don Heck was started out in the 50s. So did Gene Colan. So did John Buscema. All
Yeah.
those guys were really Golden Age guys,
You see,
technically.
Warner Roth did a lot of the X-Men stories with Roy Thomas,
Was Roy
correct?
Thomas, yeah.
And he did, I always talk about this Lois
He did
Lane's.
romance stories too. A lot of the regular people, civilian stories.
In the early 70s, I got a Lois Lane book. I guess it was 71. And the cover really caught me. It was, I think it was a Dick Giordano or maybe a Neil Adams story, but the cover caught me, and I bought it. And when I was reading it, Vince Coletta inked it. And I thought, God, this is garbage. Why did I even buy this? And Warner Roth, I've looked it up. He was the artist. Vince Coletta. I don't know how lavish the pencils were, but it didn't look good when it was finished. But Warner Roth, I'd read his books. I just never knew who he was. And then when the X-Men got big, every time you buy books about the X-Men, they'd always have those old Roy Thomas stories that Warner Roth drew. And I just always kind of dismissed him as generic. Dallas, on the other hand, loves those stories. Well, I look at them, they're good. I mean, they're nothing,
Yeah, they're
they're
good.
not bad. It's solid work. Warner Roth is one of those that to me has always been under the radar.
It's the Kirby factor.
I think you're right.
It's the Kirby factor. We don't know what's good unless you compare it to something, usually. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? There's always a comparison, and when you're pale and when Kirby is like this dynamic, meteor of like comic book incredibleness in the 60s. Everybody else, with the exception of a few, pales in comparison because they were also told to kind of like draw like him or, I mean, wasn't there the story that Stan Lee would tell people they wanted him to like use Jack's dynamics in the stories or
Yeah,
whatever? So he made them kind of like lose a little bit of themselves in a way
yeah. Yeah, well, he
too,
wanted Jack Kirby was the house look of Marvel Comics, and that was something I've always kind of wanted to talk about. Was as we said last episode on your Destination Nightmare blog, you were posting, a lot of Charlton comic stories. Charlton was a company. I'm guessing they were in the '60s. I remember.
Charlton went from the what was around in the 50s, maybe in the 40s, and ended in the 80s.
Yeah, I remember. See, I remember them in the 70s. I remember the early 70s is when I started noticing them because my brother had bought a Yogi Berra comic book.
Oh, yeah.
And above it, it said, he was really young.
No, that's cool. I'm
But
laughing and enjoyment of it.
at the top of the, it had a banner at the top or just text that said, all new stories, all new art. And I was thinking, well, what difference does that make? Of course, if you buy a comic, it's all new stories and all new art. I didn't realize a lot of times they were just reprinting stuff. But Charlton Comics, they had a look to them. I mean, and Steve Ditko worked for them. Tom Sutton, you always talked about worked for them. There was,
Don Newton started out working for him too.
right. I mean,
Giordano did a lot of early work for
Jim
him.
Aparo.
Jim Aparo,
And
yeah.
but
Staton,
yeah, that's
Zach,
right. That's where I started reading
Byrne.
Joe Staton and John Byrne. That's where I first read
Yeah.
those guys.
Yeah.
And to this day, I still see them as Charlton artists, even
Kinda.
though, but no matter what your art style was, there was a look to those Charlton
I
comics.
did work for Charlton. That's up to you to figure out what.
I didn't know that.
Yes, I did. I did.
Could you say what year?
Or 80, 81.
Really?
Yeah.
Good. What book is it? Are you going to tell
No, I'm
us?
not going to
You're
tell
getting
you.
tight-lipped, aren't
I
you?
am getting tight-lipped.
Can you look this up on Google?
Maybe. I know. I drew it. I helped another artist. I inked it and helped, but it was the bookstore had the question and the Blue Beetle in it. So there you go. Yes, that's right. I was responsible. I'll tell you what it is. It was the first Charlton Bullseye comic book. It was basically like a friend of mine went to New York looking for work, and he couldn't get work in Marvel in DC, so he had the idea to go to Charlton and go, look, can I get some work? And they said no. And he goes, well, I got an idea. Why don't you start up a book, and it can help new guys get in, and we'll do it for free. And that's when the little 8 or 9 or 10 issue run of the Charlton Bullseye started, and I worked with him on the first issue, which was a story with the Blue Beetle and the Question.
Wow,
Yes,
was it a color comic or was?
yes it was. Yes.
Let's see, it was 1970. It was either the end of 74, beginning of 75, where Charlton Comics, I always read E-Man, and they had an advertisement for Charlton Bullseye, and that's where I saw the Blue Beetle. You know
That
the.
was their take on Foom, and
Yeah.
that was their fanzine.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. You couldn't get it in a newsstand. You had to order
This
it.
was a different Charlton Bullseye that I
Okay.
worked on.
But I remember when comic stores came out, I bought 2 issues of it. You know, and it had they ended John Byrne's Doomsday Plus One, but they had I think it was a 2-part story. They ran black and white. It was the final story they never published. It was in the Bullseye. And they had an Alex Toth Question story, which fascinated me in another one. But they ended that, and then they brought back a comic in 80. I never knew that.
Yeah, you never saw him. It's here
Because
somewhere.
I know, what was it, when I was in the Navy,
I'll find the
yeah.
cover. The cover's online, so.
I'd like to see that. Yeah,
The
because.
cover's good because it was inked by Dan. It was drawn by Dan Reed, the pencil, and it was inked by Bob McLeod. So it was a lot. The cover is a lot nicer than the interiors, but the interior have like a charm to them that I really like. I really like a
I
lot
never
now.
knew that.
Yeah, I thought you did. I thought I told you a while
I know
ago.
Charlton, I was in the Navy, that's when they did Static, that Steve Ditko
Yeah,
book.
it was 81 when that happened, 80 or 81 or something like that. It's
Oh,
like a
okay.
35 years ago now, so I
Wow.
look at it with a lot more fondness than I did when I first saw it. I went, oh, I don't like this that much, but I didn't say anything to him. But yeah, it's out there.
But you know, some like Charlton, I don't know where the house style came from, but I do know First Comics that came out in the 80s. Joe Staton, I think, he was for a while he was their art director, and I think he left. I don't know what year it was, but they wrote up Mike Gold wrote up a piece about Joe Staton, about his leaving, and you know, thank you very much for what you did. And he said he was a lot of reason First Comics looked like they did, even though Howard Chaykin and all these other artists, you know, did their own series on it, and it was basically a I think for the most part it's a creator-owned company. Everybody owned their work. But they had a distinct look. When you saw it, you could tell it was the first comic. And I don't know, that's something that kind of fascinated me. But a Charlton comic, even if I see it on your blog, immediately I could see it was a Charlton comic, no matter how old it was.
I love Charlton Comics. I love them because they're just like, it's just different. You know, I mean, they weren't superhero comics generally. There were some, but they were mostly those like horror and romance and all that. And if I ever see any anywhere for like a really good price, I don't care what genre it is, I grab it because it's like, it's just cool. It's like, I don't know. It's not Coke or Pepsi, but it's like RC Cola or whatever. It's still good, you know?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
it's still a comic book and it's still a lot of fun. Like I said, Don Newton and Byrne and maybe even Roger Stern, I don't know.
Do
And
you have a favorite Charlton comic? I mean, is there one in particular you just love them all?
I love the horror ones because I always more of a horror guy. But
Yeah.
I mean the, Byrne's Doomsday was one plus one were good. And they had black and white magazines. Some of the Emergency, they did a
Yeah.
comic book Emergency. Oh, I'll tell you a good one too. Some of those were good because they were drawn by the Krusty Bunkers. So you'd get a Neil Adams and
Yeah.
Giordano and whoever was there. I really liked their Space 1999 because those were drawn by like Gray Morrow, Vincent Alcazar, and people like that. Those are really nice. And those were
Those black and white,
magazines.
yeah.
There was a magazine, but there was also a color. And I think the color comic was. I don't remember who drew it because I don't
John
have too
Byrne.
many of those.
John
Maybe
Byrne
John
drew it.
Byrne, yeah, and like Jack Sparling did the Bionic Woman, and I think he might have even done the $6 Million Man, and they were kind of like I don't know. There was this just cooler in a way, you know. I mean, it wasn't just the run-of-the-mill, you know, Marvel guys, which I love. You know, it was just different. They were the cheap comics, you know what I mean? But they were always on the stands in where I lived. I mean, I
Me
don't
too.
know. Oh,
Yeah.
they had them in Oklahoma
Yeah,
and all
Charlton, they
that.
always had. Then those Steve
Oh.
Ditko horror books like Ghostly Files of Dr.
Yeah,
Graves.
Haunted Tales, and then became Haunted
Haunted Tales
Libraries.
had that blue witch woman, right? She was kind of
Yeah,
the
she was
spirit.
cool. Yeah, Midnight Tales and
Yeah.
stuff like. Yeah, that's right. The blue woman with the shade, with the
Yeah,
glasses.
she had bangs, long hair,
Yeah.
and always short skirts. And what was weird was she would introduce the story and then she would just appear in the story. Like there was one,
Yes, yeah, you
she introduced
remember.
the story about it was a veterans hospital, and she talked about all these old veterans, and she said basically they were all telling tall tales all the time, and she said one old man in particular told the biggest whoppers of all. And then as the story progressed, every once in a while, you know, these guys would be telling these stories, and she would be in the background as a nurse, you know, just changing something or picking something up or moving something. That's so weird. What's she doing in the story? And then, I remember that story at the end. He was telling these stories about how he was, you know, basically Audie Murphy in World War II, holding off the enemy sides. And then, at the very end, he died. And there was, I guess, it was a nurse there crying, upset, and the doctor was talking about it. Doesn't make any sense. He died of bullet wounds. And he never saw a battle. You know, it was all tall tales.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, Audie Murphy was a World War II hero that became an actor.
Yeah.
Look him up. I'm sorry, I'm giving references to stuff people
Yeah,
may
yeah,
not
yeah. He
know.
did plenty of movies too. He was the most
And
decorated soldier in World War II, I
from what
think.
I'm told, he was extremely crazy.
Yes. Well, you know, there was the other Charlton Horror magazine called Scary Tale, and that had another hostess. So she was called Countess Blood or Von Blood, or she was like in red. And she had like long red hair, and Joe Staten usually draw her. And
I
it
don't
was,
remember her.
yeah, it was Scary Tales. And she, but I, and in the first issue they give you her origin. It was like Countess something von Blood, Bludd. And I was like, oh, that's her name or whatever. Those were the two. I don't remember the one in blue that Ditko usually drew, that lady. But
Yeah.
von Blood was the other one from Scary Tales. And Midnight, and this one here, Midnight Tales, had like always had this doctor and his it was this doctor and his daughter, and it was and then most of them were drawn by Wayne Howard, who was kind of like a big he was I'm sure he was an assistant to Wood, but he always had that like kind of like Wood Wally Wood style or
Yeah, I was just
whatever.
saying, it looked kind of like bad Wally Wood. I mean,
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
sorry to
yeah.
say that, but it looked
Yeah,
like
he
if
had
Wally
that.
Wood drew it and they got somebody to ink it really quick, you know.
Yeah. That's Wayne Howard. Wayne Howard's also an African American artist from back in the day when there weren't that many. You
Yeah.
know, I don't know if there's that many now, but you know, I'm sure back then. But yeah, it was like he was an assistant, and then he had his own little Wally Wood style,
Boy, he does, yeah.
which was competent enough. It told the story or whatever. Yeah, don't forget Pat Boyette was another guy
Yeah, he was
in
another
all these
Charlton character.
magazines that did, like we said, Apero, and like Warren Statler did a lot of the Western stuff.
I'm not familiar with him.
I thought Wayne Statler was who's the guy who Warren Statler wasn't he the guy? Okay, I'm getting confused with the guy who. Oh, there's another guy we talked about before. Warren Kremer, yeah, that's right. Not Warren.
Yeah.
Yeah, Warren Kremer
I'm
is a different guy. Warren Statler was another guy that did a lot of work for them too.
not familiar. What, he did Western work for
Yeah, I think
Charlton?
so. And I think he did. Well, I think he specialized in Western work or
Wow.
whatever. Yeah, Giordano did a ton of work for Charlton. He was an editor in Charlton, like in the '60s, I believe. And
Yeah, he was the editor-in-chief of Charlton.
Sutton, you know, Tom Sutton, almost like the king of Charlton, and Tony Tallarico did a ton of stuff. He's got a story in here. Sparling worked for them, and Toth actually did two stories for Charlton. One day, I think one of them was a horror, one was a romance, and Giordano basically like said to Toth, and, you know, Toth wanted to get him to work for him, and Toth said, "Well, I'll work for you, but you got to make me the highest paid
Yeah.
artist." And somehow or another, he found out that he wasn't. I don't know who was, but he wasn't. And he said, "I won't work for you anymore." So we could have had Toth, but yeah, no, we got from Toth. We got a horror story, a romance story, and in the Charlton Bullseye, there was a question story,
Yeah, which
which is a great
yeah,
one
I've
too.
got that one.
Which, you know, he could do no wrong back in, you know, ever. You know, I'm, you know, very early Toth is kind of like Milton Caniffes, but from the early or mid 50s up, they could do no wrong.
But
But yeah.
I never liked it when Somebody else inked Alex Toth.
You know, he did a romance book called 20 Miles to Heartbreak for DC. It was a series in one of the romance books, and it was inked by Coletta, and it was nice.
Yeah, sometimes, I don't know, there was a World's Finest story. I remember, I liked the cover because Gil Kane drew it. You know, this is 83 or 82. But the interior, and when I say this, it was kind of funny saying it now, but it was an Alex Toth story. And it was about Superman and Batman, you know, it was World's Finest as a team. But I think Superman had a brother who was more powerful, and it was an odd story, but it was a long, long story. And I think Terry Austin inked
Yes,
it.
I've shown that to you before, yeah.
Well, I like Terry Austin, but I didn't think that story was very good. I don't know how much Alex Toth put in it. It was a long story. But it wasn't the best work, and I don't know if it was because of Terry Austin or just because Alex Toth was just knocking it out. But.
Well, the worst Toth was like a very, and Dallas and all that, this one. I think it's X-Men 13. He was inked by Coletta in that too, but it was only Alex Toth layout. It's bad. I have the actual issue. It's really bad. But Coletta, if Coletta got good Alex Toth pencils, strong, he could do a good job on it. I mean, they were both cut from the same romance comics, 50s.
Coletta
kind of
had the chops, so you just normally didn't get it.
He was cranking it out.
Yeah, he was cranking way too much out.
All right, well, let's take a break and play some music, and we'll be right back.
She says, I've been better, but I feel all right. Baby, smoke it till it's out of sight. Will I never get to sleep tonight? Lavender lover, hey.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
The Torpedo book? Yeah.
I was trying to get it off Amazon, but I think it's out of print.
Not sure. They keep reprinting them in one form or another. But anyway, we're back.
And who did we play?
That was Superdrag with the song She Says, kind of a Beatlesque number from a demo from their second album, Head Trip in Every Key. Got it right this time.
Nice. They're a great band.
Yeah, they are a great band. They're still around. They broke up, but they're back. And if you see them in your town, go and the concert. I saw them in 2000 at a little club in Fort Lauderdale, and they were pretty great. They're a good rock and roll band from Tennessee. I don't know if they're from Nashville or from Tennessee. Good old hard rock from the lovely state of Tennessee. And you're really into that Torpedo book.
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to get it. And every time I try, it's out of print.
No, you know what? No, they reprinted them a year or two ago because I remember I rebought one. And I thought it might have been different ones, but it was just a reprint of that with a different cover. They may still be available on Amazon.
It's got two short Alex Toll stories in the front,
which were published in the Warren magazine. And then the rest of them is Jordy Bernay, a damn great artist himself.
Well, I'm going to say, thumbing through this, normally if you have Alex Toth and then it's followed by somebody else, it's nothing but awesomeness and then bitter disappointment.
Not that one.
Boy, I'm going to tell you, I saw the Alex Toth story, and right on the next page is Jordy Bernay. No disappointment. I'm looking like, my God, that's...
Jordy Bernay's work on that almost looks like Alex Toth's ink by Joe Kubert.
Yeah, I was going to say, it reminded me of Joe Kubert in a way, but not really any way I could put my fingers on it, because he's his own person. But
Bernay's great. He's still around.
He is great, and he's right up there with Alex Toth, and that's saying something. Anyway, we're not talking about these guys.
But it's a great book.
Oh, that is a great book.
Yeah, this thing I bought like in the 80s.
Yeah, it has that. The paper has that 80s feel to it.
Yeah, the cover has that slick 80s feel to it. There's about four or five of these. I don't know what the company was. It Catalan Communication, or was it what was the company that did this? Catalan Communication.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yep, there's about five of these, but they keep reprinting them. I remember in the 80s, they actually came out in, you know, comic book form, like a small, you know, form, and they put like 8 or 9 issues. I can't remember who reprinted them, but these are amazing, man. And they're violent, and they're sexy, and they're like, you know, this is a great take. This is a great take on the gangster stuff. And like you said, no letdown. No letdown from Toth to Jordy Bernay.
All the way through, it's good. And if you stand up to Toth, then you're something.
Then you're a real man.
You are a real man. Anyway, we're talking his request about some of the I don't want to say C artists, but they were artists.
Artists,
you know,
or whatever.
They were artists that weren't always the superstars. You know, and we talked about some of these guys before. When I was growing up, and I said this, one that I always thought was Don Heck.
Yeah.
I was seeing Don Heck work, and when I'm talking about Don Heck, I think I saw some can you think what the stories were now?
Was it an Iron Man or something?
Well, see, I hate to say Iron Man because I always thought Don Heck was the worst hack in the planet. And I remember he was doing, I think Godzilla? Was he doing those Godzilla stories?
I think that was Herb Trimpe doing those.
Or was it Shogun Warrior? He was doing one of those books, like...
I don't remember.
And in that Marvel...
No, Trimpe did Shogun Warriors and he did Godzilla.
I think Don Heck did some Godzilla stories. But in that Marvel Comics Untold story, they made a comment that Don Heck was always in the office, and he was always, you know, trying to get work. And the joke was, you know, you can give him anything. If nobody else wanted it, Don Heck would do it.
Sure.
And
money.
I'd see work. I'd always buy some comics, and he'd be the artist, and I'd get upset as a kid, like, you know, 12, 13, and I just, why did I buy this guy? I hate this guy. And I heard some artist on a couple of artists in an interview, and they were, somehow Don Heck came up, and they said, I always felt bad for Don Heck. He said, because he was never interested in doing superheroes. He always seemed like he's more interested in doing, you know, romance-type work. He says he could have been a little slick newspaper artist. And I'm thinking,
I agree.
At the time when I read it, I thought, what are you talking about? I says, he's just a hack. Well, I've seen some of those old Iron Man stories he did for Marvel in the 60s. Wow. Complete polar opposites. The guy was unbelievable. And I think you said he did do romance work.
Yeah. Actually, the first Don Heck story that I ever remember seeing was an early issue of The Avengers. It might have been issue 38. And, you know, the whole thing was by him. And it was real nice, man. I mean, even as a kid, I liked it. You know what I mean? But sometimes you could tell he was rushing it a bit. And he was another guy that would get anchors that weren't wouldn't be the best for him or whatever. Did you ever see, I think it was in Avengers. I'm not sure what comic. Don Heck, inked by Wally Wood. There was a comic book. There was a Marvel book. I remember like the Scarlet Witch and Pietro were in it. It might have been in Avengers, and it was inked by Wood over Heck. Beautiful.
Well, Don Heck, I'll tell you, he was something. In that early work, when I see it, I just want to see more. I'm going to guess, and this, he just wasn't interested in what he was doing after a while.
I think it was just a matter of getting it. He was one of those reliable guys. You know, he did it really fast, like Sal Buscema.
Yeah.
You know?
Sal Buscema was greatness, but the problem was he was doing layouts, and he was doing so much work, and he said on some other podcast that Marvel realized he was a go-to guy, that he understood how to break a story down, and so they could assign it to him, and if the thing was late, they could call Sal and get Sal to get it done, or, you know.
And give it to an anchor after that to finish it off.
But some of the story, like I think he did Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, that was a mouthful. And those were actually good. But there was a lot of Sal Buscema stories, a lot of Sal Buscema stories. And they were all like shorthand, and I just never really enjoyed them much.
Once again, he got when he was doing his layouts or, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, light artwork, not finished art, he would get some inkers that would just, like, you know, destroy it, kind of. Not destroy it, but it wasn't a good combination, you know what I mean? Don Heck needed somebody a little tighter, maybe, to do his work or whatever. Like I said, Wood did a great job, and there was a couple of others, but if he got, like, Coletta or somebody like that, it was just readable. He told the story, and that's really an important thing for an artist to do, but getting back to Don Heck, I remember that I was never a big fan, but I liked his work, but I got one of those essential Marvel books, and there was some early stuff that he did. I forgot what, I think it was an early Iron Man. It was in black and white. And when I looked at it in black and white, I was like, I'm not seeing the same stuff that I saw before. It looks better to me in black and white than it does in color.
Yeah, I could see him being a lot better in black and white.
I mean, some of the stuff that looked like, whatever you want to call it, like bad hatching and the line work seemed to be more understandable to me in black and white. And maybe because of the coloring, you know what I mean? Maybe the coloring made it look not as good as it does when you see the starkness of it in black and white. But he was a way better artist than people give him credit for.
Well, he did some fine detail work on it. He had I guess what he calls a gentle style. You know, it was subtle. He added stuff. And so I could see where the coarse, you know, newsprint comic books they were printing in the 60s and 70s, a lot of that would get filled up, you know, and then you got the color on top of it. So, yeah, I could see where it get lost. Whereas black and white, it would show up quite well.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys like that. We were talking about, again, not a favorite of mine when I was a kid, but more appreciated now is Larry Lieber.
Yeah.
He was doing all the Western stuff, and it was like, at the time, it was like, well, yeah, this is okay, you know what I mean? But I look at it now and go, like, it's a lot of fun to read, you know?
One of my favorite stories, Larry Lieber, I think, wrote it and drew it. It was a Wasp story.
Yes.
In the 60s. She was in a department store, and I guess the magician took over. And that was famous because Alex Ross in Marvels even used one of the panels in that story where the Wasp is. She was at the department store because they had fashion that was inspired by the Wasp. And one of the mannequins was wearing a ski suit, you know, but it was a Wasp ski suit, you know, listen to me.
It's easy for you to say.
And but in Marvels, he had that panel painted right there. And I thought, you know, it's just, he was a good artist. He even wrote stories and was a good writer. And he had a whole it wasn't just one thing. You know, he wrote superhero stuff, drew it, and, you know, westerns. He did all kinds of stuff. He was quite good.
Well, here's an example of a book that I regard highly now. But back in when I was a kid, it was just like, you know, I bought it basically for the reprints. This is Creepy number 27 with a beautiful, you know, Frazetta cover. Now, when you go through the contents of this book, you've got an incredible Steve Ditko story.
Wow.
As the first one, collector's edition. And you pass the Ditko, then you got a new Telerico story. You go, huh, not so good. And you pass that one, and you got this beautiful Coffin of Dracula wash story by Reed Crandall. You're going like, oh my God, that's incredible. You know, all reprints. These are the reprints, by the way. And then you got a Seton story. You go, well, it's okay, but not as good as this Angelo Torres, Al Williamson looking thing. Yeah. And you're going like, whoa. And then you go through that, and you go, that's incredible. And then you end up with Ernie Colon, and you go, well, kind of cartoony, but not as good as Steve Ditko, Reed Crandall, and Angelo Torres. The problem is like I really appreciate Tony Telerico, Ernie Colon, and Tom Sutton a lot more now than I ever did. The problem was when I was looking at this book when I was a kid, they were overshadowed by some of the greatest, you know, illustrators to work in comics back in the day. Now I can see how good these guys are, and I'm not, like, whatever you want to call it, you know, sucked in by the beauty of these other artists. I already know how great those other artists are. I'm kind of, like, appreciating Tom Sutton, Colon, and Telerico. Tom Sutton is another unbelievably, you know, artist that people don't, like, you know, put in the category they should be. An amazing, quirky, weird artist that was able to do every genre. He specialized. It was better at horror than superhero and stuff like that. But a guy that really, like, deserves to be, like, you know, discovered again and shown to be, like, an interesting guy or whatever, you know, as far as, like, comic book artists go. A guy that deserves to be, like, considered more. There is a book of Tom Sutton that just came out. And I think Craig Yeo put it out. It's definitely worth checking out.
Tom Sutton's one of those artists that I'm just, I know his name, I know his work, but I'm not, when you talk about it, it starts bringing it to the front. He is one of the best. He's just, I didn't read a lot of horror, and I wasn't that familiar with him. When I see his work, I remember some of those stories. He is terrific, but he wasn't one I always thought of right away.
No, because he didn't do super, well, he did a lot of stuff in Charlton's and Warren's as opposed to, like, Marvel and DC's and, you know, some of the other, you know, more mainstream or at least more superhero or more action-based. Even though Sutton did a lot of work for Marvel, I mean, a good amount. I mean, he inked stuff. I've had books where he was inking, like, I think he inked Barry Smith on a Conan story. He inked Gil Kane on, I think, a Warlock story. He did do work for them, and he did some beautiful, the magazine of Planet of the Apes. He did some beautiful work for those. As a matter of fact, here's another guy that people don't talk about much, but he is great, is Mike Ploog.
Yes, yes.
Mike Ploog was an excellent, excellent artist. He started out in the late 60s, early 70s. He was the assistant to Will Eisner for many years on that PS magazine.
He was one I absolutely loved. To me, though, I kind of put him differently. He was a great illustrator. He ended up doing movie work.
Wizards and all that stuff.
Yeah, the Wizards work was some of my favorite, the illustration. But I didn't realize on Facebook, there's a page, and he posts stuff like storyboards he did for Dark Crystal, a Jim Henson movie. I'm trying to think. He worked on a lot of movie stuff, doing storyboards and design work.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I look at the Marvel stuff he did in the 70s, the Man Things, the Ghost Rider
Monster
work.
Monster Frankenstein, Ghost Rider.
He,
Planet of the Apes.
He had his own style, but I look at it, it has a Romita feel to it. You know, like
Eisner. Eisner inked by Romita, maybe, or something.
But, Mike Ploog has a unique look, but the Marvel stuff, you know, Marvel, Jack Kirby was the house style, but as Romita came in, it started getting a Romita look to it as well. But when he left and he came back in the 80s, he's doing work for First Comics, and First Comics were just making a big deal about the return of Mike Ploog to comics. And he was doing those Lone Wolf and Cub covers for a while. It was a different Mike Ploog. And I remember he did, when First had the Classics Illustrated, I think he did Tom Sawyer. It was a different style than what I've seen. He's doing cover recreations now. He did that that King Cole comic cover.
Yeah, a lot of them are. And, yeah, commissions and stuff.
But
like
they're
that.
Staggering. They're not. It's the same comic cover, but it's a lot more detailed, and you know, he's putting a lot more work in it than a monthly comic cover. Yeah, he's kind of a forgotten sort of.
Bit real forgotten. I mean, he'll do something. I think he did a cover for a. He did some work a few years ago for the Spirit comic book,
yes,
cover
he did.
Or something like that, or maybe an interior story. I'm
I think
not sure.
he did a lot of that.
But in the 70s, he was one of the new guys, and he made an impact. Him
yes.
and Sutton made an impact back in the days. I mean, for different reasons, you know. But I think people maybe look at Ploog a little more fondly because he actually did a lot more work for Marvel. He didn't work for, I don't think he ever worked for DC. He did do work for Warren, though, because there are a couple of Vampirella stories that he did early 70s and stuff like that. Here's another forgotten artist who did incredible work from back then is a Frank Brunner. He did beautiful stuff for Warren, and even he did a story for Castle Frankenstein. He did an incredible Doctor Strange run,
yes.
Howard the Duck and all that. Nowadays, I mean, he'll do commissions and stuff like that, but totally forgotten.
You know, Frank Brunner, like I said, in the 70s at Marvel, he was the man. And I remember when Pacific Comics came out in the 80s, that Alien Worlds, they had
yeah.
a Frank Brunner cover. Well, there he is, because I always liked him. Yeah, he's just, I don't know. He did an Elric story, a painted Elric story. He ran in heavy metal.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
It was just, it, I don't know how long it went, but I guess it'd be a graphic novel. And I was wanting more of that, and I never saw any more.
No.
I don't know. He might have done movie work or something.
He was like an early, one of those early fans. He came around the same time, kind of, as Colluto, Wright, and Jones and all that. But he was a little different than them. And then he hit his peak in the 70s, and then he started doing the same thing as them, doing prints, going out on his own, doing occasional story. Then he hit with Howard the Duck around that time. But then he didn't do too many of those. And then he was replaced by other artists that did him and stuff like that. But he really hit his peak in like the mid to late 70s or whatever. And he kind of like, didn't he do work for Pacific or and stuff like that? Didn't he do another Duck kind of story for like Star Reach or one of those?
He might have been, because all those guys are doing work for Star Reach.
The last
thing I remember him doing and was that Alien Worlds cover.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that he didn't do anything else. That's just the last thing I remember seeing. Because it was just as good, if not better, than the work I saw in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I'd see his name once in a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm
he
guessing.
Did, he did a page for that Creeps magazine that I bought. It's okay. It's not the best for, but it was okay. Here's a guy that I'm ambivalent about. Maybe you'll like him better than I do. He was kind of like, I don't know, maybe back in the 70s. He did a good amount of work. He was kind of like a Bernie Wrightson type. But what did you ever think of Val Merrick? Did you ever like his work?
Yeah, I did, but I guess it's a funny thing. I remember he did a story in Heavy Metal magazine. I think it was him. It was a black and white story,
probably.
And it made no sense. It was, I mean, the drawings I thought were great, but I mean, why is? It was almost like if you had a 16mm movie and you were just filming your friend, and he's at this party, and he's getting irritated at people right in the middle. And he does this big giant middle panel of him in the middle of all these people and said, if I don't like what I'm getting, there's going to be a lot of serious ass kicking around. And he was a thin, muscly guy, kind of in a martial arts pose, like he's going to fight. And this woman came up and kind of talked to him and soothed him, and then next thing you know, they're making out. And I don't know, it was an odd story. And I think that was Val Merrick. I remember seeing a lot of his Howard the Duck stuff, you know. I always kind of looked at Val Merrick is they couldn't get Gene Colan, so they got him. But I do like a series he did with Steve Gerber, that Void Indigo.
Oh, I remember that.
For Epic Comics. My Marvel had the epic imprint. That was some of my favorite work. And Void Indigo was it was one of the graphic novels that came out. And I thought it was incredible. It was rough. Actually, if we ever do another lending each other the books, I pulled those out to lend to Rook. But the closest thing I think of is that first Highlander movie is what it sort of reminded me of. Frank Miller was talking to. He went to DC with an idea for Superman and Batman, and Steve Gerber went there. Was it Steve Gerber? Or was it Steve Englehart? It was one of the Steves that came from Marvel. He went to DC with an idea for Hawkman, and DC turned them all down. Ended up his idea for Frank Miller's idea for Superman and Batman was Dark Knight. You know, he reworked it, but the Hawkman story the other guy had ended up being Void Indigo.
Oh, alright.
And it was about a race, this alien that ended up coming to Earth and then living as a human. Well, after that graphic novel, they did Epic Comics picked it up as a series. And they only did two issues and canceled it. And I'll tell you, it'll put some hair on your chest. I remember that first issue starts out with this black prostitute. You know, she has a blonde wig and you see the cleavage. And these men are coming over messing with her. And one man pulls the knife out and says, "We know what you're up to." Ends it up that prostitute was a man. The wig, the blonde wig came off, and it was a guy with a, you know, balding man with fringe. But he had breasts. I guess he was a transgender. I'm like, what? And it just kept going from there. It was just one, it was like the whole underbelly, and they showed everything. And Val Merrick was a great artist, but he had a roughness and crudeness that I didn't always like that much, but for what he was doing, it worked. I love Void Indigo, and after the second issue, I was asking a couple of friends, "What happened to that book? When are they going to do another one?" And a friend was just completely disgusted with it and said, "Oh, they're not. It was just too much."
Okay. For 1980, it would probably fit in right now.
Yeah, unfortunately, now it'd probably be an AMC TV show.
Yeah, right. It'd probably come after here, I'll throw another name, another Marvel name at you. And this guy was actually a Golden Age artist, George Tuska.
Yeah, he was one I never...
I liked Tuska.
I liked Tuska better after reading the Will Eisner, The Dreamer. You know, when he worked for him and he punched what was that other guy out?
Bob Powell. Another great artist.
Who is fantastic, but he deserved it.
Yeah, in that respect.
But the George Tuska stuff, I used to get, you know, reprints, you know, in Marvel books and stuff, and I'd see some of his newer work. He was one I didn't like. It wasn't bad work. It wasn't my favorite.
I like it. I really do like it. I think he's a solid artist. I mean, some people complain about the expression on people's face. Maybe they have big teeth or something like that.
The one thing to clarify all this stuff, Mike Sikowski, you know, we talked about artists we didn't like
the
as kids.
The Speed Demon, Mike Sikowski.
But as a kid, I love those old Mike Sikowski Justice League stories. I even liked his Wonder Woman work. I thought was good. I just didn't enjoy it because she
like
was
the Emma Peel Wonder Woman.
Yeah, see, when I started collecting comics, that was the Wonder Woman was out. And every time I see reprints of the, you know, the superhero Wonder Woman, I said, "What happened? I like this one better." You know.
I understand.
But I did like Mike Sikowski. And as I gotten older, I don't enjoy it as much. I also liked whoever the artist was that did World's Finest, you know, Superman and Batman and Robin stories.
Novik.
No, that was later. It was a cartoonier style, more of a Kirk Schaffenberger, Mike Sikowski style. I guess they were 50s stories. But they were a lot more cartoony.
You're not talking like Dick Sprang or anybody like that.
It might have been one of those guys.
I like Dick Sprang.
I love those stories. But those are the kind of artists I liked. I didn't care for George Tuska too much. I absolutely did not like him. He just passed away, too. Barry Smith's friend.
Trimpey.
Herb Trimpey. I've never liked Herb Trimpey. I've seen some of his Hulk work that I remember finally. Some of it was kind of dynamic, but a lot of it I liked because John Severin inked it.
Yeah, I agree.
But every once in a while, though, I'd see something, like a cover or something he did. So that's different. That's kind of unique. But George Tuska, I mean, Trimpy was one I didn't care for. George Tusk I liked better, but there was a wonkiness to it sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. And we failed to mention, I'm glad you mentioned his name, the late Herb Trimpy, who passed away a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
So at least we're getting, we're paying our respects to the guy. I like his work now more than I did when I was a kid, because I always thought he was kind of like a more cartoony version of Kirby. Even though, like, in a way, early Barry Smith was a more cartoony version of Kirby, too. You know what I mean? But now I like it with a fondness of going back and seeing it and going, this isn't as bad. But at the time, yeah, not so much.
I guess Herb Trimpe, I see some of his older work, and some of it catches my eye.
Some of it does, yeah.
And he didn't improve. To me, he didn't get better. It just seemed like he just got...
Well, towards the end of his career at Marvel, they were telling him that he should change his style to be more like the Image guys.
Yeah.
So he tried to do like a Rob Liefeld knockoff, and no, it didn't work. And actually, I remember reading an interview or an article about him saying that basically Marvel one day just fired him. Nobody would give him work, so he ended up going back and getting his teaching certificate and became a high school teacher.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
For years. And another thing I didn't know about him, which I read about it in a Wikipedia page, he was also an ordained minister who actually received the Medal of Valor for helping out or for doing work during 9/11 in 2001 in New York.
Well, so, I'm liking him better and better.
Yeah, he was like he was a pretty righteous dude. I mean, I met him at a Tampa convention. He did a sketch, and he was very nice, you know. And other people that I know that have met him or talked to him or dealt with him say he was always a good guy.
Well, there's people that I respect that just carry on about him. And they grew up reading G.I. Joe, so of course they love the story.
Oh, yeah, G.I. Joe.
But, you know, again, part of that you and I talk about was certain artists, we read as kids and we love them. And it doesn't matter what they do, you just always remember with a great fondness. I remember a guy on my ship read G.I. Joe comics, and when he finished them, he just passed them on to me. And I just thought, I didn't like them.
Was Trimpy drawing them?
Yeah, Trimpy was drawing them. And I don't know, there was no thought or imagination. It just seemed like a guy going through the motions, in my opinion. But, like I said, on Facebook, there's just countless tributes to Herb Trimpy, and people loved him. And he does sound like a stand-up guy. I remember he said him and Barry Smith were friends, and he helped him out when he started out. So,
yeah, I mean, and there was always a couple of artists that, I mean, I talked about this years ago with another friend of mine, where it was like, this guy did work for every company, but he would usually, like, let's say Dell or somebody that would do an Outer Limit comic book or a Twilight Zone or something, and it would start out strong. They'd have a Reed Krans or George Evans, maybe like a Toad story, and then as it kept going, it would change. I guess they didn't want to pay or something, I don't know. More than likely, especially in Outer Limits, it would start out real strong and then end up being given to somebody like Jack Sparling. At the time, you were like, oh my God, it's Jack Sparling. I love his work now. I truly do love his work now. But at the time, it was like, oh, not him. You know, so you'd stop buying the book. But it was done right. It was done kind of sketchy and loose. But the guy, was a professional. He did his work and it was readable. And if you were maybe a little less discerning than I was, or a little less discriminating, or whatever the word is, back when I was a kid, or full of, like, myself as far as, oh, the only good artists are, like, Reed Crandall, Al Williamson, and Frazetta, and all that, then you were always inadvertently let down. Now I love his work, but there was a lot of that going on, where it was like, oh, my God, this is great, and all of a sudden the Sal Buscema issue shows up, and you're like, oh, no. The Sal Buscema ink by... Joe Staten issue, and you're like, oh, man.
One thing I never, it's completely lost on me, as Roy Thomas, Dark Horse put out those Conan books. They were reprinting all the old Marvel work. I love the Barry Smith stuff. I didn't like the coloring in them, but I bought every one of them.
Yeah.
And what I enjoyed more than anything was Roy Thomas was talking about how that book came about, that he was a big Robert E. Howard fan. He found out that the license was available, and he convinced them to... let him do the book. Well, when he was putting it together, John Buscema wanted to do the book. That was the kind of work John Buscema liked. He wasn't a superhero enthusiast. And they wanted John Buscema, but they couldn't afford his page rate. Even though it was Marvel, I guess the Conan book was just untried, and they said, well, they wanted to get him, but they couldn't afford to pay it. So they were going to get his brother Sal, who had the lower page rate. And I never thought about page rates. I figured if you worked for Marvel, they could just get any artist you wanted. And they ended up getting Barry Smith, who was an untried artist who turned into some superstar. But what was the other one? Steve Bissett on Swamp Thing. He was in an interview in, on Panel Borders with an English, it's an English radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about when they were doing Swamp Thing, including Alan Moore, they had low page rates. And he said Steve Bissett did some work for, I can't think of the writer, but it was with Keith Geffen. And when they were talking about putting in for the work, they found out what their page rates were. They were the lowest page rates DC paid. And he said, oh, what? And he said, listen, have Keith put in your page rates for you. You'll be happier. Really? He says, I'll tell Keith. So the guy sent him to Keith Geffen. Keith Geffen put it in, and he got Keith Geffen's page rates, which was higher.
Mm.
And he says, man, that was the nicest thing they ever did. But he said, Steve Bissett, John Tottleman, and Alan Moore were getting the lowest page rates DC paid.
And then, but within like a few months, that book became a big hit.
Yeah, but they still got the lower page rates.
They were still getting the lower page rates. That's unbelievable.
But see, that's something I never think about. I mean, and I'm surprised Keith Geffen was getting a higher page rate. You know,
been around for longer, I think.
Yeah, it's in, I mean.
He had been doing stuff for a few years. He was doing Legion around that time and stuff like
but,
that.
But I just never thought about, I understand some, my buddy Britt, we're talking about artists. I never liked Dick Dylan very much.
He's another one.
Yeah, Dick Dylan's another one.
Mr.
Now,
Justice League of America.
I see his work and, I don't know, when I see this, a lot of times seems pedestrian to me, but every once in a while I see a panel or I see a page that I just find breathtaking, and I think that's kind of genius. He was on Justice League Forever.
Forever.
And when I'd get the books, I liked the Mike Sekulski reprints, but when the Dick Dylan books, this is before I was really discerning artist, I would get excited because it'd have a Nick Carty cover. And I'd read the inside, and I didn't enjoy it as much. And sometimes some panels, I'm like, God, why am I getting this? This isn't good. And I'd be like 9 years old thinking this. But there was a book Dick Giordano put out about creating comics. And it said, with Dick Dylan. And it had a picture in the back of Dick Dylan. Seemed like an extremely congenial human being. And when I was in college and my friend showed me this, I'm like, I hate that guy. And then he asked me why, and I told him. And Brett's reply was, those guys make more money. And it was just staggering, because we were talking about Barry Smith and Michael Gold and all that. And he said, yeah, but think about these guys only put a book out how often? It's just Dick Dylan does it every month for how many years?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's not right, but I don't know. And page rates is something else I don't quite get, but
I don't either.
I guess if you're an established artist with a following, but Alan Moore had a huge following,
Yeah, I didn't know he was getting paid so low. I mean, I would think that at first he would be, but then within like a year or two, the page rates would go up.
It must have been.
But then again, these guys made a lot of money off reprints, I'm sure, All that stuff's been reprinted countless times and stuff like that. Well, here's the thing, too. Well, even though Marvel did their Conan comic book in, I think, 70, like this here, the paperbacks were still a big deal. For that, a paperback.
Oh, yeah.
And this is from 69. It's got Barbarian of Fear with a character called Thane. So they were already kind of like, the basic premise was going to be happening anyway. And it was starting out in some of these books or whatever, with the Frazetta, giant barbarian dude cover or whatever. So it was inevitable. But yeah, I remember I bought within like a range of, I don't know, maybe a few months, the first Conan and the first Vampirella at the Liggett Rexall drugstore on 41st Street and Palm Avenue, which my dad would take me to on occasion when I, give me some comics, and he would take me down there. And I bought some of my very best comic books there. So I'll never forget that place. I think it's a little furniture store now or whatever, but, it's memorable to me. Some of the greatest books ever. Anyway, anything else you got, man? Any books you want to talk about that you've been reading or anything?
Yeah, this is a funny one. There's a book I've been subscribing to, And actually, I wouldn't do it, but you showed me the first issue of it. It was Bud Sagendorf's Popeye.
Oh, yeah, the reprints.
Yeah, and I've continued to get it. I know you stopped, but I told Pat after issue 31, I just sent him a note.
It's been that many already?
Yeah. Oh, I said, stop getting this for me. And he says, okay. And I went in the last town to get my books, and he said, I know you stopped getting Popeye, but a few are coming in. I said, oh, yeah, I expect that, you know. So I got issue 32, and the reason I stopped getting Popeye, it's not because it's not good, it's just that I got tired of it, you know. I mean, it's a fun book. These are all reprints from the 50s, you know, and Bud Sagendorf was the assistant to E.C. Seeger, who created and wrote and drew Popeye. And after he was gone, Sagendorf took over the newspaper strip. Sagendorf was a good artist. I liked him, but I found his Popeye comic strip work kind of sophomoric and generic compared to Seeger's. But anyway, IDW and Craig Yeo started putting these comic book reprints out, and they're strong. The stories are written for younger kids. But I'll tell you, every one of these books has three stories in it. You know, if you're a kid getting it, it was something back in...
And this is a reprint of an actual comic book from the 50s or
Each one is... And it used to be they had comics on the inside covers and on the back cover. And I noticed as the issues went up to like 20, they stopped putting the back jokes on it. But anyway, I stopped reading them. I kept getting them. I have probably 8 issues that are just sitting there that I haven't read at all. So that's why I said, you know, stop getting it for me. Well, issue 32 comes out, and the cover just catches my eye. I love that cover. It's a strong graphic cover. It's funny. And I've always kept on the top of the stack just because. Well, the story on the inside is basically, you know, it's kind of nice, but all these people are disappearing in the town. Turns out the sea hag hired some guy. And he's got this giant machine with claws on the end, but the panels get bigger. It's a scope. I mean, it's different than the other ones. And finally, you know, Popeye realizes he's alone. And you're seeing an aerial view of the town where he says, I feel lonesome. You know, and it just keeps going. Finally, the sea hag takes over, comes in. I mean, some of the pages, you know... See, the Sea Hag's machine knocks Popeye through 2 different buildings in the shot. I'm thinking this is, it's different than some of the other stories. I really enjoyed it.
And so now you want to keep getting
them. Well, I was thinking, oh, jeez, you know, if this was here earlier, I'd still be glad. This is a 32. I'm not going to get any more. I imagine I still got a couple more coming down the pipeline, and that's fine. It's a great book, and it's one I'm enjoying a lot, but I just, after you read so many of them, you just get a little tired of it. But I got this, and this is one that just kind of, it brightens my day. I'm really happy I have the book, and I'm glad they're putting these things out. I read Popeye comics from Gold Key in Charlton. You know, I'd always get them at garage sales when I was a kid. I don't know. I think Paul Fung drew those. And he used to draw the Blondie and Dagwood comic for
Charlton. Oh, is that what the guy's name was? Okay.
Paul Fung. He was, they had that look from those books, you know, and
yeah,
he was kind of, he was kind of crazy and over the top. I saw some animator at a convention one time talking, and he started talking about how Paul Fung is really crazy. I'm guessing he worked in animation maybe, but he did a lot of Charlton's funny comics like Blondie and Dagwood. And they were kind of zany and over the top. It's almost like some of those radio morning shows where everybody's crazy and plays cowbells
the morning
and stuff.
Zoo, yeah, right.
But I don't know. You read the books, it's kind of funny, but after a while you get tired of them. But these Sagendorf books, he's really changed my opinion. I thought he was a great artist, and you know, but these stories are a lot better than the newspaper strips he's doing in the 70s.
Oh, okay. Well, those are from the 50s, right?
Yeah, the 50s. Yeah, early 50s, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I bought the first 4 or 5, and I kind of got tired of them a little bit, but
yeah.
That's a cool-looking book.
Yeah,
it
one
really is.
That one really stands out. I mean, they're all good, but number 32, I really enjoyed this one.
Huh.
You know.
Good stuff. Are you still getting the news stories of Popeye?
No, the news stories Robert Langridge was writing, and they ended after 12 issues.
Okay.
And he drew the 6th issue and the 12th issue. He wrote and drew it and lettered it, and it's fantastic. Barney Google appeared in with that Barney horse Google. Spark plug.
Yeah, I remember those.
They appeared in, I think, the 12th issue.
So those are the King Features guys or whatever, yeah.
And, but yeah, that was a really nice book. I really enjoyed that one. He used like 3 different artists drawing this book. He wrote them all, but each issue was by a different guy, or a rotating three different artists. But I did enjoy it, but after 12 issues it ended, but the Sagendorf work keeps going. But
yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of issues from the 50s.
It was a monthly comic. Sagendorf did a book about Popeye in the late 70s called The First 50 Years.
Oh.
It's a really nice book. He illustrated it. It basically introduces you to the strip. He tells the story of E.C. Seeger, has pictures of Popeye statues in Illinois, and has, you know, parts about the animated cartoons. This is when that stuff was almost kind of gone in the late 70s. And he had one page, and it had a photograph of all these old comic books from the 50s. And I saw them. Man, those look really nice. And, you know, I was a young man at the time when I read those, or read about them. And now I see them coming out. It's kind of nice. They're graphic covers. They're really, really nice. They're funny.
It might be the original cover of the book. I don't even
yeah,
know.
Yeah, it is. They are
it
the
is original
covers.
Okay, so he's just doing the entire book.
And it's kind of a heavy stock paper. It's not newsprint.
And the reprints are real good.
And
I mean,
the covers,
obviously getting them from real good
Yeah, the covers
copies.
Are kind of a cardboard as well, and it holds the color well.
I mean, when you look at the book, it's probably a reprint from the exact comic book page. It's very, it looks like you're reading the actual book.
Yeah, and it's not like a bad copy.
No, it's not like a bad copy.
They really put a lot of care into it.
No.
Moving on, Dollar Box Fine.
Flash Gordon.
Yeah, this is number 5 from Dynamite, but I guess what they're doing is 4-issue story arcs. I got this from the cover. The cover's fantastic. It has Ming the Merciless, it has his daughter, I can't remember her name now, and it has a really awesome-looking dragon-type creature, and Flash Gordon holding some kind of ray gun. And like I said, I bought it for the cover. It starts out... it's 2 different artists. The first half of the book is one artist. I think it's a woman. You can see her name on the first page.
Page 1, Lance and Color, Sandy Gerrell, part 2. Oh, part 1 is Sandy Gerrell, part 2 is Evan Shaner.
Yeah, I think Evan Shaner maybe did the cover. I really enjoyed the story. It's got Flash Gordon, Dr. Zarkov, and Dale Arden in that ship that brought him over there. But the thing that surprised me was the characters, the dialogue. They seemed like real people. And they went back to Flash Gordon being a polo player, like, you know, he was in the old strips. And but Dale Arden, she's not a woman in distress. She was like a scholar. She's talking about papers and research, and she's a really strong character with a mind of her own. She's not a woman in peril. Dr. Zarkov, he does seem like a real professor. And but it shows him escaping. They describe how Mongo works. It's like all these planets are all kind of looped together in this one tunnel. Well, I can't remember exactly how they say it, but it's like some type of hyper freeway that connects them. And basically, they escaped from Mongo. I didn't read the first 4 issues.
Oh, did you buy that one today?
No, not today.
Oh.
I wouldn't be talking about the story if I bought it today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I bought it a while back, and I just read it, and now I'm already forgetting exactly. Somehow the planets are linked. But reading this one, they're talking about they just left Phrygia, and they're talking about they're going to the Hawk planet. You know, where, I can't remember the man's name, the Hawkman.
Yeah.
But it's, they have you convinced it's a good distance away, you know, and how they're linked. And somehow Earth is there, and they have a crystal key to unlock Earth. And everybody's wanting to portal to Earth. And this is really good storytelling. The first half of the story I liked. It's a simpler style. But then when he gets to the second part with that, Evan Shaner, it makes me think of, who's the guy who did Zenozoc Tales?
Mark Schultz.
It's like a simple Mark Schultz.
Kind of,
it's
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it is.
And they're on Hawkworld, but it's kind of a different Hawkworld. They really convince you the differences of the planets. I'd like to find some more of these.
Did you look today?
Yeah, I didn't see any of them.
Okay.
I've got another Flash Gordon I bought in San Diego last summer, and I enjoyed it, but I didn't enjoy it as much as this issue here, you know.
There you go.
So it was fun.
The cover's real nice. Some of the interiors are nice. I've never seen it before. I never saw it there at Comic World or anything like that.
I've heard for years about the Flash Gordon comic. I've seen them. But I don't think Dynamite was doing it, or it was a different series, but I didn't like the artwork. This one, even though it's two different artists, I liked them both. And it's pretty strong work. And I got one more book, another dollar box find.
Well, those are good. I haven't seen one of these. Starlight by Mark Millar and Goran Parlov. Yeah, these are real nice.
Well, like I said, the cover caught me, because the cover, it's like an old guy dressed up like Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers in old serials. And Mark Millar, I know he's a popular writer. Sometimes people, I think Dallas had an authority that he wrote, and it was fine. And one of my students had Civil War. And I read those, and it was, you know, not something to seek out. But this one, it was the artwork. Gordon Parlov?
Goran Parlov, yeah.
Where's he from, do you know?
With a name like that, probably from like a Eastern European country, I would think.
But I'll tell you, I'm looking at this. He's got his own style, but when I look at it, it reminds me of Mobius as the Inkle. He's got that Mobius Inkle style.
Yeah, he does.
And
a little bit of Toth and a little bit of Mobius.
But you know, I'll tell you, when an artist is trying to copy an artist, it doesn't always work. It's usually stiff, and you know, you can tell you're trying really hard to mimic. This one, it seems like he invented the style. He's got it down, but when I'm reading, it's not like, oh, I wish Mobius drew this.
No, it's strong.
This one is really strong, and this is the third issue. I put it on my wish list trying to find it, but I found out they have it was a 6-issue run.
I have some of the issues.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I'm missing that one, though. I never got that one at the comic shop, but I have some of the other issues, yeah. I didn't know it was over.
Well,
I don't think I got the last one. I know I have the first two and maybe the fourth one or something like that, but that's all I ever got in this series.
It ran for 6 issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found the trade. They put it on a trade, so I'm going to get that.
Oh, they did
so
put
here,
a trade.
This is yours, then.
Okay, thanks, because I know I'm missing this issue.
All right, well, that one's yours.
But I'm also missing probably the last one, which I have to find all of them. Oh, so you are getting it as a trade. Okay,
yeah, I got on when I found it was in a trade, I thought, well, I'll just get that one. But I'll tell you.
Oh, it's beautiful.
If you're looking for something good to read, get Starlight. If you can find the single issues, get them. If you want the trade, get it. But
yeah, he's like an old astronaut that has to come, that goes to another planet to save it or something like that. He's like a retired old Flash Gordon, like astronaut or whatever, save the world
yes.
or something like that.
Well, that's
that.
What they're talking about, and I guess the kid recruits him.
The kid recruits him, to save his planet or something like that, even though he's like retired.
But
yeah.
The story is, I really enjoyed it. Like I said, I've read other Mark Millar stories. I know he's got a wide audience, and that's fine, but when I've read his stories, it's not like I ever wanted to read any more. When I'm reading this one, I really, of course, at the same time, this is something in my wheelhouse. I like Flash Gordon. I like this kind of work. I really like the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something I found in the dollar box, and I thought, well, I'm gonna read it. My
That's
God,
one.
This one's worth, if I would have paid $6 for that issue, I'd still be happy, you know, so.
Yeah, and this is published by Image.
Yeah, it's another Image book. But
now
anyway.
I have to find my other ones, but I do have them in a box. I read like the first two. I think I missed that one. And then I got 4, which I think was a double issue. And then maybe I never saw 5 or 6.
Well,
very sporadic. I mean, it wasn't coming in like on a regular basis at the store.
Yeah, so. But you can write down the issues you're missing. And, you know, it's worth dollar box diving. It's worth back issue diving.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah,
worth,
yeah.
you know, ordering it from an online seller.
Yeah, it's good. It's
so,
good stuff.
Yeah, it's. I really enjoyed the books I read this week.
All right, man. Well, we did an extra long show for the people, so I hope they enjoy it. And
also, if you listen to the show and there's an artist that you feel was underrated, or what you know, some people consider I hate to say it, a B artist or even a C artist. Share it with us on the Facebook page. You know, and there's a lot of comics that I read as a kid.
That you don't know who drew them.
Well, I don't remember who drew them, but like some people, you know that character Tigra from Marvel?
Yeah.
Byrne
did some of those.
Yeah, did he really?
Byrne, I think Vosburgh did some of those too.
Well, you know, Tigra was a character I liked because I had that giant-sized werewolf by night that introduced her, told her.
Yeah.
Still, to this day, one of my favorite comics. I always pull it out and read it and really enjoyed it. And whenever Tiger would appear, like in Fantastic Four or something, I just always enjoyed her. And somebody said she's more like a D-list character. And I said, not to me. She was always an A-list character. Well, to some people, maybe the work is a D-list for the artist or the story. But to other people, it's a bright light in your life. So if there's any artist that you feel that, you know, doesn't get the respect that you think they deserve.
Or a comic book character, for that matter.
Yeah, anything. Writer, creator, comic book character, series. Feel free to share with us on the Facebook page.
Definitely, yeah, because we'll talk about them, because we may know about them, we may know more about them or whatever. And if someone wants to send examples, please, go right ahead.
Very good. Anyway, thanks for listening.
We're going to have more. I think we're going to come up with some more shows with, like, the four originals of Two Dimension.
Yeah, Dallas is trying to get the core four back, I guess, after 6 months.
To do a few more, you know, shows.
But I have a feeling Rook will be doing something on
Well,
that
then
day.
It'll be just the three of us, and maybe, you know, maybe Company Ice.
Yeah, maybe Des will be with us.
Who knows? Stay tuned. See who shows up.
Anyway, in the meantime,
read more comics.
To find Al's other podcasts, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and
click on the Cyclops!